Now calling case number A220784, North Star Mutual Insurance Company versus Christopher Erickson.
And again, despite being on Zoom, I want to remind you that the rules of appellate procedure do apply. Each of you will have 15 minutes to present your case in chief, with 5 minutes being reserved to appellate counsel for rebuttal if you choose to exercise that. Please, just a reminder, please state your name and indicate which party you're speaking on behalf of before beginning your remarks. And Ms. Jansen, you appear as appellate counsel.
Correct. Thank you, Your Honors. My name is Janine Jansen with Jansen & Palmer. I'm here on behalf of the appellants, which in this case are the Walters, and we, having had a Miller-Schuchert agreement in this matter, are also stepping into the shoes of the Erickson's for the purposes of this appeal. This, as the court may know, is an insurance coverage case involving injury to a minor while she was attending a daycare. The appellants, the Walters, entrusted their daughter, R.W., to the daycare of the Erickson's, beginning in 2011 when R.W. was 1 year old. I will not obviously use names further in this case. I'll use initials if that's okay. C.E. was at the time a son of the Erickson's. And at the time of the incidents involving this that give rise to this claim, CE was between 6 and 7 years old. And as I recall, RW was between 3 and 4 years old. I might have that slightly off.
Ms. Jansen, I think we know probably the facts that, I mean, we're dealing with the complaint, I think, is what we're looking at this stage, right? For the facts.
Correct.
And can just to set the stage a little bit to make sure I understand where we are. Are we reviewing the district court's decision that there is no duty to defend? In other words, is this case about the duty to defend?
It is, Your Honor.
Not the duty to indemnify. Yeah. Okay. So a duty to defend doesn't necessarily, as we know, include a duty to indemnify. So there could be a duty to defend that doesn't include a duty to indemnify, right?
Correct. And the procedural posture is set by that in part because those two issues were before the court on summary judgment. The duty to defend is broader than the duty to indemnify. And there can be a duty to defend when there is no duty to indemnify. In fact, one of the arguments that we make in our briefs is, and made below, was that the district court erred that by conflating the duty to indemnify and concluding that there was no duty to defend because he couldn't imagine a scenario in which there would be liability absent sexual molestation.
What we're reviewing is a duty to defend. Even if we were to reverse on that, there would be another question about a duty to indemnify that's not before us, right?
Correct. It would be remanded for further proceedings in the district court.
Okay. And then in terms of the claims that are at issue now before us, as I think I'm reading it, but I want to make sure I understand. And I understand, you know, that if there's duty to defend on one, there's for all, et cetera. But the claims that you're challenging seem to sound to be the negligence, right? So the negligence claim, vicarious liability, negligent supervision of a minor. And then I think you're asserting a negligent defamation claim. But that's what we should be focused on in our review only, right?
Yes. Okay. The district court dismissed some of the intentional act claims, and we didn't take issue with that.
Okay. So I think what we come down to, and we can then get into probably where you're headed, which is the alleged I mean, the claimed rather exclusions. If we were to read the, and I think importantly, we start with the definition of bodily injury and what sexual misconduct means, which we'll call, and everyone has been calling an exclusion, right? An exclusion from that definition. So can you, let's hear from you on that. Why is the conduct as alleged relative to these claims that are left, these four? And I think particularly the defamation is a little bit off on the side a little bit more, but the three negligence claims around the child CE's acts. Explain why that does not meet the definition of, at least for duty to defend, of sexual misconduct.
Correct, Your Honor. You have it all in terms of the procedure correctly aligned. This case is unique, I believe. It is, as far as I can tell, and I'm sure that counsel would have raised case law if there was their case law. It's the first case I've ever seen in Minnesota involving a child as young as CE was at the time of these incidents. And so as the court is aware, general principles of insurance coverage and the Walters are now stepping into their shoes, et cetera. The issues with respect to this exclusion, because there's never been a debate about whether this bodily injury definition operates as an exclusion. And so the burden of proof is on the insurer to prove that the exclusion applies. In this case, the definition of bodily injury excluded sexual molestation, that was the primary term, which was then further defined by the policy to include a number of things, sexual touching, you know, there were a number of them that were pretty obviously sexual molestation and some that were broader. And what's unique about this case is that there are a number of cases in Minnesota law, more recent cases by the Minnesota Supreme Court, involving intentional acts exclusions, which are different exclusions, and I'll grant that, where the Minnesota Supreme Court has carefully parsed the question of whether capacity to control one's impulses is excluded by an intentional acts exclusion. Now,
that case is still WICA, State Farm versus WICA. I mean, that's still controlling case law where someone who's mentally disturbed does not, they distinguish. I found it instructive because the Supreme Court distinguished between what is required for a tort action versus what is required, what is looked at as far as the insurance exclusion. Do you agree with that holding?
Correct. Yes. And what's important, I think, about both WICA and BMB and then other case law that's followed that line of case law is that it looks at intentional act exclusions, criminal act exclusions, et cetera. And it does something that wouldn't be allowed, for example, in criminal law. In criminal law, irresistible impulse is not necessarily a defense in Minnesota, but irresistible impulse is considered under the intentional act or criminal act exclusion of an insurance policy because of this overlaying factor of giving the insured the benefit of their bargain, construing ambiguities in favor of the insured, et cetera. And that's particularly true when we're talking about a duty to defend. So the thing that I think becomes important about this case is the fact that in the definition of bodily injury to exclude sexual molestation, we can't avoid the problem that was present in WICA and BMB in that the capacity is lacking, or at least there needed to be evidence that either that CE was had the capacity of, I think the youngest age of any, I'll use the word perpetrator. I am a former public defender, so I think in those terms, but the person who's alleged to have engaged in the activity is a minor. And I believe the youngest age is Steele. Steele is...
Just to bring us back to focus on the bodily injury exclusion, I think what you're doing then is arguing by analogy or trying to, or incorporating, seeking to incorporate the intentional act exclusion analysis or the intentional injury, however you read that exclusion, those cases under WICA, et cetera, into whether this is bodily injury at all. And does sexual misconduct as defined, and I think the word is sexual misconduct, that's the umbrella term, not sexual molestation, I think, at least what I'm reading.
In the contract. Thank you, Your Honor. Yeah. You're right. You're correct. Sorry.
So whether sexual misconduct itself as the as whether that falls within bodily injury, does that require an intent? And since, well, I think, does it require the perpetrator's intent to do that act? And I think the argument is it's not a subjective intent question, unlike the intentional act. And also the secondary question I want to get to is, oh, but yes, but in your complaint, you repeatedly say it was intentional and therefore must be held to that. So speak to those two things, please.
Understood, Your Honor. Well, there are two things. I think that the case that is probably the most critical here, really, in terms of analyzing this problem, would be the Miller case. The Miller case, as I recall, is Court of Appeals. I'll take a look just to make sure I've got that correct. And the Miller case, oh no, it's a Minnesota Supreme Court case. It's from 1999. It involves an adult male who engaged in the act of molesting. And as I recall, Your Honor, I think the exclusion in this case defined bodily injury to exclude sexual misconduct. You're correct. I'm sorry, I misspoke. But then sexual misconduct is defined as molestation, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And the thing that is a critical distinguishing factor here in my mind that makes this case, makes the Miller case instructive really in this case, is that in Miller, the court, as I recall, I believe it's Miller, talked about the difference between molestation as an act and molestation as a condition. And when it did that, it used a dictionary definition of molestation. I believe the word in that case was molestation. To my mind, they're not really that different here, because sexual misconduct is defined here, and the list of things that count as sexual misconduct all involve actions. So unlike Miller, which is at least in my mind, the strongest case that the state can be relying on here, or I'm sorry, the state, what am I saying? That the insurance company can be relying on here. The policy language is different, and policy language is critical to an analysis of an insurance coverage case. The policy language here has definitions, so we don't go to dictionary definitions, which is one of the mistakes that I think the district court did. And the list of things that qualify as sexual misconduct includes acts, not conditions. So why is this not,
when we look at sexual misconduct, it says bodily injury does not mean, et cetera, arising out of any actual alleged or threatened sexual misconduct, period. Sexual misconduct includes, but is not limited to, and then it's a litany, sexual molestation, sexual touching, sexual harassment, et cetera, or any act, conduct, communication, which is of a sexual or seductive nature. Why doesn't what is alleged here factually constitute sexual misconduct, in your view, on a facial reading of the policy and the complaint, in light of, or not, the non-exclusive list that follows? So why isn't it sexual misconduct?
Because sexual implies a motivation. Because the word sexual is a motivating factor. I don't know how, I don't know how you can say that a 6 to 7 year old has a sexual motivation. Because on the facts,
that's cognitive ability, you know, and I guess why I found what could be instructive is because, you know, one of the comments by the court is we don't want to create a situation where, and I'm going to refer to intoxicated people or under the influence, that you have a greater defense because you thwart the intentional act part of the exclusion. I mean, does the age of the child make a difference? What if the child was mentally ill? What if the child was under some illness that caused him to just simply act out? I mean, doesn't WICA stand to that proposition that we parse these two definitions differently?
I believe it does. I believe that this is that the fact that this policy, in its definition of what is excluded, speaks to acts that are motivated sexually. I believe that requires that the insurer, as a part of its duty,
it doesn't say motivated. It says sexual acts. I mean, you're putting in a word, right?
That's your correct.
All right.
Correct. Yes. Sexual touching. Yes.
And I'm sorry. Go ahead and sum up. Your time ran out. I got on a kind of a last minute tangent there.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. No, I'll stand on our briefs. This has been argued strenuously by both sides. Thank you very much.
And thank you, Ms. Jansen. And again, you'll have your 5 minutes for rebuttal. Thank you. We'll turn to you now, Mr. Storm.
Hello, is my audio still good? Wonderful. My name is Paul Storm, appearing on behalf of Respondent North Star Mutual. The court has focused in on this question of the bodily injury definition and that subset of removing the sexual misconduct from bodily injury. The first point that I want to note is that the argument that's being offered by the appellants is that we should be reading in a word that does not appear in the definition. The primary argument is that sexual misconduct should be viewed as having some sort of intent, that the word sexual means a motivation and that a motivation means an intent. And that progression is not an automatic or required or a necessary progression. It's a leap of logic to say
but
that.
Is it though? What does sexual touching mean?
The argument that we propose in our brief is that sexual touching, what the absolute exterior edges of sexual touching might be, is not the issue in this lawsuit. That when we're talking about allegations that someone forcefully stimulated someone else's genitalia,
okay,
that they
but
tried
neither
to
of
have
those
someone
words
else do
appear in the complaint. There's no stimulation. There's no sex act. There's no, I'm looking at the words of the complaint, which we're supposed to look at. And that's what I want to focus on. Because I know your brief and what you're saying now, talk about stimulating, talking about sex acts, et cetera. But what we're talking about, what's described in the complaint, is a 6-year-old boy who touched the genitalia of a 4-year-old. And there's a 6-year-old boy alleged to have, alleged to have wanted to, or, you know, indicated desire to, you know, put his penis in her mouth. I don't know if that happened. Okay. So without describing that as a sex act, without describing that further, what makes that sexual touching, touching the genitalia? Because obviously touching all genitalia is not sexual. We know that because parents do it all the time when they change diapers.
Certainly. The complaint characterizes it as being sexual assault. The phrase sexual assault is one of the counts, of course, one of the intentional counts. Each of the negligence claims says that as a direct and proximate result, this individual suffered physical and sexual assault. So these
every claim does.
Oh, I mean, I was really looking negligence claims.
Excuse me. Even the negligence claims, one of them, count 8, says sexual assault. Count 7. Count 8 does negligence. Count 9 does not. Oh, wait, no, it doesn't. It suffered sexual assault. Okay, so my apologies. So then, and it's oddly, it's listed in what the child suffered in the damages and says suffered a sexual assault. So your argument, okay, preliminary argument is that I guess the plaintiff has to be, you know, the Walters have to be held to what they put in their complaint, that it's a sexual assault. So therefore, that means, so end of story because of that. But what if it weren't there? Can a child, what if these were 3-year-olds? Is that a set? What if the child?
Apologies, Judge Smith, your audio turned off.
Oh, my apologies. What if both children were, if the complaint didn't use the word sexual assault and it's negligence claims, it just described the conduct as it does in the original allegation, the initial allegations where it's factual. And then when you get to characterizing the claims, didn't use the word sexual assault. Would 3-year-olds be engaging in sexual misconduct if they did the exact type of touching that's and conduct that's described factually in the complaint?
If the plaintiff's complaint, the underlying litigation, if that complaint set out to prove that it was sexual conduct, that's what is compared against the policy. If what they're trying to establish is that 2 3-year-olds performed activity and it was a sexual assault, then conceivably this exception to the bodily injury scope would apply. But I would note that there is also an exclusion for physical abuse. And if it was determined that the activity was not necessarily sexual, but was nonetheless offensive or was problematic because it created harms, then that arguably would be a physical abuse and therefore would be outside of the bodily injury that's contemplated by the policy.
So if when I'm looking at, the reason I'm focused is if we pull out the intentional towards. Okay, so now we're focused on the initial factual allegations that don't describe, you know, I don't even think they use the word intentional when they're in the factual allegations. Once you get to the, what characterization of the different counts, then the word sexual assault is used. And sometimes maybe even, well, predator is used, as you pointed out in your brief, sexual assault. And then in one of them, intentional. I'm just wondering how much that characterization in describing the complaints actually dictates if the factual allegations themselves in a coverage case actually would permit the negligence claims.
I don't think that the word sexual necessarily requires us to go to this when it's used in this definition of bodily injury. I don't think that term requires us to go to the question of, well, is it sexually motivated? If it can be described as sexual contact, if I encounter some individual and I have no reason why I mean for them to experience it as a sexual act, but I'm offering just a kind of a crude one. Let's say that I'm in a locker room setting and that I'm the coach and I'm trying to make a point and I do something like slap one of my individuals on their backside, or I grab their crotch and I'm yelling at them while that's going on. They might perceive it as an act, a sexual act, because a primary organ has been implicated. And if my position is that's not what it wasn't meant to be sexual, it was meant to be intimidating, or it was meant to be humiliating, or it was meant to in some way grab attention, I shouldn't, as the perpetrator of such an act, be the one who controls whether or not it could be classified as a sexual misconduct. I think that most people would agree that if someone makes unwanted contact with primary sex organs, and that if there's no consent to it, if there's no reason for it other than I want to impose some kind of intimidation or harassment on someone, I don't think that I get to argue, well, it's not sexual harassment. It's not sexual conduct.
The definition for criminal purposes, and I know we're not there, for sexual contact, is in fact that there is a sexual or aggressive intent. It's touching someone somewhere with a sexual or aggressive intent. And that's statutorily defined. I understand that. But it's just, you know, this idea of that a 3-year-old or 4-year-old could consent or not is already anathema to the idea of what children can do, whether like the unwanted and consented to. I mean, there's no such thing as a 4-year-old consenting you know, to a sex act, obviously. So that doesn't fit very well. And at the same time, on the other side, a six-year-old's motivation to touch the private parts of another child, to call that sexual without any sort of, you know, like in the criminal realm for older people, touching someone with a sexual intent or aggressive intent. I mean, it also just, would the reasonable insured really read these things to mean a child touching a child when so many of the doctrines don't really fit in that context?
Well, I would note that in the DWH by way of Mitchell case, that's an instance where an 11-year-old, the Supreme Court of Minnesota found that an 11-year-old could not claim that they were not engaged in sexual behavior because they were too young to appreciate it. That's under the age of 14, which in statutes is a cutoff that we have for whether a child can be criminally liable. But we have already said that an 11-year-old can be considered someone who, for purposes of coverage discussions, could be considered an individual who's engaged in some type of sexual act. And then our trouble, of course, becomes, how could we draw a line? Where would we draw a line? If our case law already says that 13-year-olds and 11-year-olds, that sexual conduct is something that for purposes of coverage can be attributed to them, then where do we say that that gradient changes? Is it at 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, at what age? We don't have that. Our case law on the civil side with respect to coverage determinations doesn't ask this question of what is the individual thinking, with the exception in WICA and in the BMB decision of where there is credible evidence of mental illness. And you'd note that the BMB decision from 2003 is explicit at its conclusion that it is not disrupting anything about any other case law. It looked specifically to the issue of mental illness and said that's the issue that we are resolving with the certified questions that were brought to us. BMB was said in its own language that it is not meant to be analogized or crossed over into other fact patterns. And I think that's relevant because what we see in our past history and our case law is that this concept of a sexual activity, there is no inquiry about what the person was thinking. In that Miller decision that has been referenced, where they talk about the removal of sexual acts from bodily injury, they note there that we understand what a sexual act is when we see it. We understand that it's not just the act, it's the condition. The point of Miller is that this is an acceptable definition, that a bodily injury definition can exclude a concept like sex acts from the types of injuries that are being covered.
Right. But a sex act, again, that's not the phrase in the policy, but a sexual phrase in a policy, I think, is a sexual misconduct, that's our umbrella. Mm-hmm. And misconduct implies, does it not, some sort of, it's not just a sex, even if we assume it's sexual, if you touch, and every time that you touch, that one touches another's genitals, which can't be true, because, I mean, we wouldn't describe it that as sexual touching when a doctor touches a child, obviously, even though they're touching genitalia. So, and there's something implicit in sexual too, to me, it seems. And then, but the misconduct also implies some sort of deviance from norms, but you're saying it doesn't matter whether that person's engaging in sexual misconduct, whether they understand or not the norms, including, or whether even as a child could. I know that it's a line drawing, but the problem of the line, that's why I go to 3-year-olds and 4-year-olds. I mean, they could hurt each other if not unsupervised, including in private parts. You know, I mean, they just could. That could happen, right? So I'm just wondering, is that always sexual misconduct? It seems to me that in your view, it's just because it involved more a child's private parts.
Part of the allegation here, the notion of the lawsuit that animates it, is that it's unwanted contact, that it's something that was not invited, that was not asked for, that is not consensual.
I don't think any of that is alleged, even if that could be. I'm not sure it is alleged, except by calling it sexual assault, I guess, by using that phrase. But I don't know that the facts say unwanted or unconsented, which is an odd thing to say about a 4-year-old.
And certainly, if that were the case, though, then it would be hard to envision how there could be liability or how there could be a cause of action. If there's no objection to the behavior, then there would be no cause of action. No one would feel that they've been wronged in any way. This is an allegation.
Sure. A parent might still feel that their young child was wronged by having that type of touching happen, whether a 4-year-old could consent or not. There could be harm that results to a 4-year-old.
And I'd maintain that as far as this definition, the way that it's written, it does note that it regards any conduct, act, communication, which is of a sexual or a seductive nature. And even that language is much broader than these notions of assault as a crime or of abuse, these concepts of some kind of, perhaps we'll call it a malicious intent. But these are also speaking to the idea of anything that falls in that category. Now, when we're dealing with this claim, I'd also want to emphasize for the court, if they note, that in the complaint, one section in particular, they allege that CE is a predator. That term predator is used. They're describing him as a sexual deviant. As far as the term predator in this context, there isn't any other way to read it. And if the allegation is that he's doing these things that the other child does not want, there's allegations that he had wrestled her to the floor and was described as dry humping and that it was unwanted. She wanted him to get off, but he refused to do it. There's allegations that he was using somebody to keep a lookout to avoid adults discovering him in a treehouse, trying to have his genitalia placed into the mouth of another individual. What we're seeing is a description of conduct that they consider offensive, conduct that they consider impermissible, conduct that they think is being perpetrated by a predator. And if that's the allegation that's in the complaint, and when it's read as a whole, the story is one of a child who is victimized by another child, then I think that we're well within that sexual misconduct concept that's in the bodily injury definition. Now, while that was the decision or that was the focus for the lower court, I see my time is out, but I know physical abuse is in there as well.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Storm. And we will turn back to you, Ms. Jansen. You have the last word. You remain muted.
I'm sorry, I didn't realize that. I just will speak directly to the discussions about the pleadings here, because negligence and negligent entrustment are both counts in this complaint. And obviously, Minnesota is a notice pleading state. Obviously, had we engaged in discovery and gone through trial on the merits or summary judgment on the merits or whatever, there would have been additional evidence put into this record to support or not support the negligent supervision claim, for example.
When we're talking, these are cross motions for summary judgment on the issue of the duty to defend, which not that you were arguing there is a to the district court that there is a fact question. And you typically, one would look at the complaint, right, as against the policy on the duty to defend question. Apropos of the argument that Mr. Storm was just making, why, given how the conduct was described in your complaint and characterized as intentional, as assault, sexual assault, as predatory, as, pinning the 4-year-old down, not only getting up, et cetera, the descriptions, aren't you held to that? And didn't you effectively describe what anyone would reasonably read as sexual misconduct under the policy?
Your Honor, I think one small correction here, which is that in deciding the duty to defend, district courts have to consider the complaint, but they also must consider in Minnesota law the evidence that's given to them by the insured. And in this case, the insurer denied that any of this had ever happened, which would have made these claims potentially groundless, false, or fraudulent, but would not have made them, but would not have absolved the insured of the duty to defend. So that was an important factor here. And it's something that we did discuss below, was the fact that the insureds in this case vehemently disputed whether the acts had ever occurred at all. In addition to that, it is always the insurer's burden, if it's trying to avoid its defense obligations, to present the evidence that would prove that an exclusion applied. And in this case, I think we're all agreeing that the bodily injury definition operates as an exclusion. So it would have been the insurer's obligation here. So I don't think we're locked into the terminology that is used in the factual averments of the complaint, because they were very clearly counts that involved negligence that were included in that complaint. And those negligence counts, if a jury had believed the insured, they might have resulted in no liability, but they would still have a duty to defend.
Ms. Jansen, I know you don't have that much time left, but if we felt this was a case that needed to be precedential, what syllabus point would you point us to in your client's position to support your client's position?
I believe that WICA and BMB are critical. And I think that Miller, in the sense that Miller is distinguishable, it actually gives guidance here about how to think about this form of an exclusion for sexual misconduct, sexual molestation, et cetera. In that, the policy at issue in that case did not contain a definition, a further definition of misconduct or molestation, as it used in that case.
Anything else?
No, Your Honor. I suppose the one thing that had occurred to me is that I think that, and I don't know what Mr. Storm's position would be on this, but I do think that this is a precedential case. I would anticipate that in all likelihood, this would be the kind of case that would result in a decision that is likely published. I know that was something that was in the syllabus to adjust or to discuss as well.
Thank you then. Thank you to both parties. The arguments were helpful. The briefs are helpful. It's an interesting